taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
I'm as bad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Okay, everyone. Tonight, we are actually having a conversation / debate with three gentlemen that are seeking the Libertarian nomination for president for 2020. Each one of them has their own different personalities, their own different take, but they're all striving for individual liberty for all. They just might not agree on how to get there. So we're going to start out. We're going to start out with some great introductions from each one of them. So we'll start out with Arvin.
All right. Well, guys, thank you very much for having me on this debate. My name is Arvin Vora. I'm running for president of the United States of America, and my goal is to end the welfare state and abolish the income tax. And when I say end the welfare state, that means I want to end all forms of socialism, whether we're talking about Medicaid, government schools, any part of welfare. That also, to me, includes things like military welfare, where American citizens are forced to pay for the defense of European countries. If I'm elected, we're gonna leave NATO and we're gonna cut taxes and cut military spending and military overreach accordingly. If I'm president, I'm also going to take on the role of pardoner in chief. And what that means to me is I'm going to start off by pardoning Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, and Ross Ulbricht, three great heroes. And I'm going to continue by pardoning all nonviolent drug users, nonviolent drug sellers, nonviolent drug traffickers, nonviolent drug kingpins. That's people like Ross Ulbricht. I'm going to get government out of every part of your life. I'm going to end the drug war, either through pardoning or through working with Congress or through executive orders. Whatever I need to do to put that in the ground, I'm going to do it. I'm going to make sure that I use the ability, my ability as commander-in-chief, to bring the troops home. We don't need to be the world's policemen. And if I'm president, we won't be the world's policemen. Countries will be paying for their own defense. You will no longer be paying for the defense of Saudi Arabia or Israel or France or anyone else. The military will be as small as possible in order to keep us safe, to make Americans safe. Now, you know what's going to happen if I'm going to win. Here's what happens if I don't win. If I don't win, I will use this campaign. If I'm the Libertarian Party nominee, I promise you this. By the end of that campaign, more people will be homeschooling, more people will be using Bitcoin, and more people will absolutely be using the power of jury nullification, the power that brought freedom of press to the United States, and they'll be using it to get rid of some of the heinous and immoral laws that have got our fellow citizens locked up without any just cause. My name is Arvin Vora. If you want to learn more about me, please visit my website at votevora.com.
Thank you, Arvin. Ben, your turn.
Yeah, hi. My name's Ben Letter, and I'm also seeking the Libertarian presidential nomination in 2020. And I think what we need most right now is a party, is a candidate that can put together a comprehensive plan that encourages us to win where we can win. Historically, we don't do very well in these federal offices. And there's a lot of discussion about ballot access. But what good is the ballot access if we continue to run for offices and we don't invest in those campaigns and make sure that those campaigns, you know, equal victories? From what I can tell, where most of our victories come from is from local races. City council races, county commissioner races, and things like that. And I think that we need a campaign, a presidential campaign, that's going to put special emphasis on those races that we're running, that's going to work with those candidates to elevate them in their particular communities and get them the additional attention that they need to pull off the wins where we can achieve those. Another reason that I'm running is currently in the United States, we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 million felons in this country. The majority of them can vote. Recently, we saw in Florida that Florida just gave 1.6 million felons their right to vote back. This is a large demographic that I feel belongs at home within the Libertarian Party. And I want to use this campaign as a beacon to attract them to our party so that they don't get sucked up in either the Democrat or the Republican Party, you know, beforehand and become further jaded with the system. I also think that we should make a special emphasis to run candidates that have felony convictions for the federal offices that, you know, that we put on the ballot. I think that by running felons for federal office, that will do a lot to accomplish a couple of things. It will put the word out there in a meaningful way that can't be ignored, that the Libertarian Party is supportive of this era of civil rights. And I think it'll position us uniquely to appeal to that base right there. And just to reiterate, you know, 30 million people is not a small amount of people. Only 60 something million people voted for Trump and the same for Hillary. This demographic of people alone is half of the numbers necessary to pull off a presidential victory. I've seen some statistics here lately that half, one out of every other person, either knows or is related to someone that's convicted of a felony. I'm sure a certain percentage of these people that are growing up in felon households are jaded by the system before they even have their first chance to participate. I think that focusing on this issue and bringing this group of people into the party will grow the party in such a way that it'll put us on a level playing field or closer to a level playing field with the Democrat and the Republican parties. Gary, I don't know if you're keeping time here, but I'll wrap it up. My name's Ben Letter. I'm running for president as a Libertarian. You can find out more about me at benletter.com.
I thank you, Ben. I am being pretty generous with the time. I'm not being so rigid because I want this to be pretty open and let y'all have as much time to speak and let people really get to know you, because some people don't even know you by name, and some people only know the good, the bad, and the ugly and not really who you really are. So, Dan, sir, your turn. Or, I'm sorry, sweetheart, your turn.
Thank you. So, I'm Dan Taxationist Theft Berman, and that is my real middle name. I got this name because I started a brand called Taxationist Theft, and I've really been pushing that idea to a lot of people. And I've been able to reach a lot of people, not just in the libertarian and anarchist circles, but ordinary people with this message. And when I talk to a lot of libertarians, you know, a lot of they have the fear that the words taxationist theft are going to scare people away. The reality is a lot of the messaging that the Libertarian Party is using and people in the Libertarian Party is scaring people away. And it doesn't have to do with short rhetoric like taxationist theft. It has to do with the fact that we're pushing these ideas like the government shouldn't be involved in Social Security or healthcare or all these other programs. And ultimately what people are hearing is, you're going to take that away from me. And what I've been working on for a couple of years now is really trying to figure out how to communicate libertarian ideas to everybody. Because ultimately, the problem is not that government exists. Government is a reflection of what the people want. We live in a country of 320 million people. Most of them aren't libertarian. Most of them want some sort of government. I think Ben just mentioned 60 million people voted for Trump, 60 million voted for Hillary. Other people were on the fence. Well, I don't like either of them, but we need some sort of government. We're getting what the people want. And so if we want to get closer to a libertarian society where there's less and smaller government, less and less and less, and keep going in that direction, we have to be able to communicate to these people who want government, who are getting what they want because they are the majority. We have to be able to communicate to them, hey, you know what? If you try this other system, we're not going to take everything away from you. We're not going to shut down the government and leave you stranded without roads and healthcare and clean water and healthy food and all this other stuff, which is what they, that's what they hear. We need to show them, no, this is actually going to improve the quality of your life. And so I've spent the last couple of years really working on this, and I've been able to reach out to people on the far left and the far right and explain to them, look, if we stop asking government to solve all our problems and we start saying, hey, let's figure out how to solve these problems on our own, and we take out the question of, well, how do we raise money for it? Or sorry, we introduce that question, because right now the answer is always through taxes. We'll steal it from somebody. If we ask the question, okay, how can we pay for this if theft and taxation are not options? Then people start getting creative and they start thinking of ideas. Okay, well, that's an interesting question. If that's not on the table, hypothetically, I'm sure I could come up with some way to pay for this system. And so you get people to actually start thinking and start accepting libertarian principles. And this is probably one of the most shocking things that most people don't want to hear. That doesn't happen by saying, hey, let me take this libertarian idea and shove it down your throat. It starts by saying, what's your issue with government? Oh, you have a problem with that? Okay, well, I know a little bit on the subject. Oh, you don't like the way healthcare is too expensive? Okay, so let's talk about that. And then you start introducing them ideas, and they hear those ideas, and they hear solutions, and they're like, wow, that's actually a really interesting solution. What party is that solution come from? And you say, well, it doesn't come from any of the parties you've ever heard of. Now they're interested in the idea. Now they're starting to accept it. And this has really worked. I've really been able to get through to a lot of people with these libertarian philosophies, libertarian ideas, to people who normally just sit around saying, yeah, there ought to be a law. There ought to be a program. Somebody just needs to tax the rich and pay for this program and everything will be great. So I think that's something we really need to focus on, and not a lot of our candidates are focusing on that. We're mostly just focusing on, you know, shut it all down. I don't care what happens. Screw the poor and all this other stuff. That message doesn't work. That's not what people want. And we do have to consider what people want, because if we just say freedom, 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 we're not the majority. The majority are just going to say no, government, and that's what we're going to get, and that's what we have gotten. So that's the strategy, and it's working really well. And I'd like to take that to the Libertarian Party nationally and make this our thing and really make it work.
Now, Daniel, is there a way for people to actually get in touch with you? Do you have a website?
Yeah. So Berman2020.com is the website. And I'm also on Facebook. If you go to facebook.com/Berman2020 or facebook.com/taxationistheft2, the number 2.
Okay. Awesome, guys. Now we have, there's tons of other individuals that are seeking the nomination for the Libertarian nomination for president. And hopefully at some point we can have more discussions and forum/debates with those individuals. But I want to address the elephant in the room. And I don't use the term elephant in the room lightly. I want to address the fact that the front runner, or who was the front runner, Bill Weld, has gone back to the GOP. And I don't want to know whether him being here, being a vice presidential candidate, was a good or a bad thing. I want to know if you feel that his leaving has created a void, not only in the presidential race, but also in our fundraising, in our membership, and in the direction that some people were seeking for the party to go. Arvin?
Bill Weld attracted a very specific demographic. It is the people who believe in, quote, respectability politics. In other words, people whose political ideas became obsolete 20 or 30 years ago. The people that he's brought in are great individuals, but the ideas that he's been pushing are either foolish or just not libertarian. When I was vice chair in 2016, a lot of the interviews I did were basically interviews where I had to politely set the record straight after Governor Weld had said something grotesquely anti-libertarian, grotesquely statist. One of the more famous examples, of course, was when he said that anyone on a no-fly zone should lose their Second Amendment rights. In other words, he believed that without any due process, someone should lose the right to bear arms. So he's brought in an ideology that I've made no secret, I strongly disagree with. I do not think that we need to try to be, you know, 50 years ago idea of respectable. I think we need to be focusing on the change in culture that is going to lead to a libertarian society. Daniel's right. If we tore down this government today, tomorrow this culture would recreate this government. And that's what just happened. Because during the time when the government was, you know, half shut down or whatever, during that time, both the Democrats and Republicans were clamoring to bring it back. I believe that we need to reach out to a different group of people. I think that Ben has some good ideas in terms of reaching out to people that are normally ignored because they're not respectable enough. I think we need to reach out to the people who are either harmed directly by the state, who have their competitive advantages reduced by the state. I think we need to show people that there are ways that we can do all of the things that the state supposedly does well better. Has Bill Weld left a fundraising void? Of course he has, because he brought in a lot of fundraising. He has major connections. I'm not going to be able to bring those people back, realistically. The groups that I'm going to be going after, it's a different group of people. They still have money. I do believe I'm going to be able to bring in a lot of funds, but I do believe my fundraising is going to come from radically different sources from where Governor Weld's funding came from. In terms of a leadership void, I don't believe that Bill Weld ever provided any leadership. In order to have leadership, you need to have principles. You need to have strength of character. You need to be able to be willing to face opposition and tell people that they're wrong when they disagree with you. You have to be willing to not flinch even when your battle is on the losing side, albeit the right side. I don't think Governor Weld has any of those qualities. I think it was the Boston Globe that a couple days ago wrote an opinion piece about him saying that his North Star is that he has no North Star. That's not the kind of leadership we need. My North Star is clear. It's 100-100 on the Nolan chart. And I believe that if I am representing the Libertarian Party in 2020, we're going to be bringing more people who stay, more people who can really stick to the Libertarian ideas. And I also do believe that I can bring in fundraising sources that are going to be different, but no less significant than what Governor Weld could bring in.
Okay, thank you. Ben?
I'm going to try to do a first here. Has anybody ever smoked a joint in a presidential campaign debate before? Has that ever been done?
Well, I don't know that they smoked it, but I'm sure that Johnson went to a couple of them high.
Doesn't count. You want to know how cool the Libertarian Party is? This is how cool we are. You see anybody on the screen panicking right now? No. Are we worried about the respectability that Bill Weld brought? No, any one of us can put on a suit and make general vague statements. You know, it's a long row to hoe and just the dumb stuff that Bill Weld would say. I was never impressed by Bill Weld. Never. And I know that maybe some people were. Maybe some people saw him as adding something. I don't think that he added anything other than a huge thing to fight about, because he clearly was never really that libertarian. And I can see why some people would be attracted to Bill Weld. He has a resume, he has connections and all this stuff. And, you know, people talk about media. Well, we're creating our own media right now. We don't need the Boston Globe or NBC to do this for us. We could do this ourselves and probably do a better job of it, because, you know, we're not in the business of misquoting each other and trying to trip each other up. We want to find the answers that this community is looking for, rather than just toss back and forth the political football like the old guys do. And, you know, I'm personally not really surprised that Bill Weld didn't run. I was hearing that he wasn't going to run. I didn't see a level of commitment that told me that he was going to run at all. I think he got what he wanted out of us. I think that we made the mistake for allowing that to go as far as it did. I don't think that he really brought us, you know, any big solution the entire time he was here. Like Arvin was saying, you know, I never felt Bill Weld's leadership presence in this party. I saw him as a delegate at national convention, and I don't recall seeing him take the microphone one time. Not once did he get up and take the microphone and say, I'm Bill Weld and I take this stance on this issue. He just kind of sat back there and, you know, played the middle, kind of like he talked about during the 26 campaign. We're going to go right down the middle. That doesn't work. We need to go above all that. We need to start rising above that with unique solutions and recognize that half the country's not voting. And the reason that they're not voting is because they're not buying into the Bill Welds, the Donald Trumps, the Hillary Clintons. They're not buying into that. And they're not going to fall for it. And the only thing that's going to inspire them to come out and show up at the polls is something different, something that they can relate to, something that we can relate to. Let's face it, we can't relate to any of those people. And that's why we're here trying to manifest something new. And I think that's the great journey of the libertarian journey here, is just to bring forth something unique, something new, something different to the American political landscape. I think we all share that goal. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, you were just running a little long-winded, and I don't want to spend any more time on Bill Weld than we already have.
Absolutely.
But I do want Dan to – that was not a dig, Dan. That's just – I mean, over and done with. Move on. Go ahead, sir.
All right. So I'm really not one to gossip. So I don't want to, you know, there's a lot of interesting things being said. I haven't spent a lot of time with Bill Weld, to be able to say much about him, but what I can say is I don't know what he's done. I mean, I know he's an ex-governor, but what does that mean? So he's a career politician. I haven't seen him make any, you know, I haven't seen him go out and make major libertarian strides, pushing for a specific libertarian issue and really moving the ball forward on that. So I can't say that he's a leader. But, you know, at the same time, it's okay, whatever, he's gone. You know, was he ever the front runner? I think that's reflective of the fact that we, you know, the party itself has kind of an identity crisis that it's going through. We have, you know, we have two ways to grow the party. One is to get members and turn them into delegates and turn them into candidates. And the other is to get votes. And I think we should be concentrating on, you know, getting the votes and not so much bringing in, you know, everybody just to grow the party for the sake of growing the party, because then we get people who are delegates who, you know, oh, they like that we want to legalize marijuana, but they're total communists maybe, or, you know, they like that we're against taxes, but they want to, I don't know, somehow ban or regulate homosexuality. Like we get single issue people who are clearly not libertarian, but they come in and we're just like, well, we got to grow the party. So we get these people who aren't very principled, and then they start saying, hey, well, I'm going to run for office, or we should bring in these other people. And the next thing you know, the party is splintered. Now I've made this comparison before, that, you know, we have this issue now, right, where there's 100 different genders that people have come up with, because it's no longer acceptable to be male, and it's no longer acceptable to be female, because everyone's just going around saying, oh, toxic masculinity and feminism, and so these two genders are bad. And so some people are being pressured into like, well, I don't want to be associated with that. So if you think about it, the same thing is happening with the Democrats and the Republicans. People don't want to be associated with these groups either. But what's the difference? It's a lot easier to come up with a new gender than it is to come up with a new political party, right? So now all these people are leaving the two big political parties because they want something new. And the Libertarian Party is the only one that's the only way that you can leave the two big old parties for a smaller party and still have ballot access, because the government has prevented any Joe Blow from just saying, hey, I want to run and I want to be on the ballot. You want to run as an independent? Sorry, you can't do that because you're going to have to collect signatures and all this other stuff. They make it really difficult. And so when you look at the Libertarian Party, we have a lot of people who want to get into the party and do whatever they want with it. And they're not necessarily philosophically libertarians. And that can be anybody from a delegate all the way up to a presidential candidate. And I think that's something we really have to be aware of and we have to pay attention to. And of course, you know, ultimately what's going to happen? Like, are there more anarcho-communists than there are anarcho-capitalists? And will the Libertarian Party succumb to ANCOMs and become an ANCOM party? That's a very good possibility. We don't know. And is that gonna stop me personally from having my views and changing my views? No. Is that gonna stop me from saying, okay, well, the Libertarian Party is all we have, and if there's no other way, then I'm gonna use the Libertarian Party, even though now it's mostly anarcho-communist? No. And that goes the same for other people with all kinds of other ideologies. So I think what's really important is one, we still need to focus on our messaging, and we need to understand what it is that we're saying. And we need to really pay attention to who we're electing and who we're selecting, and not just go for somebody who's, you know, got, oh, this guy's got easy access to money. He's a career politician. He's got a history. He knows what he's doing. That doesn't really make any sense, because that doesn't mean that he's going to be your voice and he's going to speak what you want to be spoken and take that to government. It doesn't mean that at all. So that's what we need.
Thank you, Daniel. Now, Arvin, I want to say that when I first met you and when we first talked, I had a lot of respect for you. Over the course of knowing you and you being in the public and being vice chair and some of the way you message some of your ideological stances, that respect has diminished. And I don't think it's because of the stances that you have. I think it's in the messaging and the way that you present that messaging. And I'm saying that not only for me, but I've also heard that from other individuals within the party. So as a presidential candidate, should you get the nomination, how are you going to avoid some of those missteps? Should you view them as missteps at all in the future? And to refresh some of the things I would be speaking about, calling all of our troops baby killers, some of the way that some of the messaging was presented in regards to teachers, age of consent, things like that. How are some of those that could possibly be pitfalls on your way to the nomination be avoided, should you see them as pitfalls at all?
The reason that I changed my messaging from very soft and very neutral and very polite, even when there were issues, you know, for example, when Governor Weld talked about banning anyone on a no-fly list, which is done without any kind of due process, from owning a firearm, the reason that I went from that very polite messaging to much more incendiary messaging is a couple things. First of all, the very polite messaging was not working. What I was seeing happening is military recruitment happening, not just within the Libertarian Party, but on the Libertarian National Committee itself, where an LNC member announced that he was joining the Marines after talking with other LNC members who'd been in the military. And to me, and of course the response was like, rah, rah, military is good, etc. And to me, that allowing that to continue was simply not an option. I do not think it is morally okay to join the military, but I think it is far worse for people who are older and hopefully more experienced to encourage others to join the military. I get that you can make a mistake when you're 17 or 18, but if you're in your 30s or 40s and have that experience, it is your job to provide guidance to the younger generation. Now, the things that I said about the military have been, you know, rephrased millions of times. So what have I actually said about the military? I absolutely did say that joining the military makes you a murderer. Later on, I adjusted that to saying that I guess if you're not in combat, maybe you're an accessory to murder. The reason that I used that particularly incendiary language is I wanted that issue to be the focal point of the libertarian movement. I wanted to throw it into question. And the result was that it was thrown into question. And across the libertarian spectrum, massive pages ranging from, you know, Anarchy Ball to Liberty Memes, etc., found their voice. Major parts of the libertarian movement found their voice and started speaking what we all knew to be true, which is military rah-rah is not libertarian. It's foolish. It is backwards. And so when it comes to, do I consider going after the military a misstep? Absolutely not. Do I think I could have done it better? Of course. Every day I work on improving my messaging. Every day I work on finding better ways to phrase things. Every day I find ways to make my outreach stronger. But the other option of being silent while something so heinous was going on, that is simply not a morally acceptable option to me, nor does it is it a politically strategic option. On to the next issue, we talked about government school teachers. Government schools are morally wrong. It is a type of welfare. It is a type of welfare that I oppose. You know, Dan talked about, you know, what happens if you get a whole bunch of socialists in the Libertarian Party, and I almost had to laugh. I didn't out of politeness, but we have that right now. The number of people who support government schools in the Libertarian Party is unacceptable. It is bizarre. It is bizarre that when I say government schools are wrong or government schools are welfare, that I am the one that's shown as being incendiary. Within the libertarian movement, there should be no room for government schools at all because there isn't. There's no room for an anarchism. There's no room for it in minarchism. So when I go after government schools as a concept, yeah, that gets the message across a little bit, but it is simply more effective and more incendiary to create the issue by going after the sacred cows of the state. In that case, it's government school teachers. In the other case, it was soldiers.
Before you continue, let me ask you a question. And sure, I might do this often. I might interrupt people, so y'all don't feel bad about that. But much like when we talk about the anti-military, it's not that I'm anti-military, and it's not that I'm pro-military. I am more of a pro-peace type of person. I'm more of an ending all wars type of person. And I think that on both spectrums of that, from the people that are pro-military and are adamantly pro-military within our party, and the individuals like yourself who are definitely anti-libertary military within our party, I think we lose sometimes where we have been in the past of being the pro-peace, the anti-war party, and we have allowed the Democrats to abscond with that issue when it is very much a libertarian issue, and we often focus on the negative as opposed to the positive, you know, being pro-peace instead of anti-war as an example. But are you, within that messaging, and I understand the whole respectability politics thing, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm the national chair for Outright, for God's sake. And everybody knows the people involved in that, right? So my question is how can that messaging be non-respectability politics, still be something that is positive, as in pro-peace, and not be, not that we don't want to attack, but not be so incendiary that it drives people away instead of works as education? Does that make sense?
I think I understand the question. A lot of what people forget is that the largest outreach that I've done has been on major media, you know, whether it's international media, you know, like RT or something like that, or, you know, domestic media. And there, my messaging is, you know, what's more appropriate for that environment. I mean, what makes sense on Facebook doesn't necessarily make sense on Fox. They're just two different ways of communicating. When I'm talking in those areas, I specifically talk primarily about leaving NATO, because I do not think that American blood and treasure should be wasted protecting Europe. I think socialist Europe can defend itself from communist Russia. I don't think it's our job to be wasting our blood and treasure on something so stupid. When it comes to military, I think I want to make it clear is that I am not generally anti-military. I believe that joining this military at this point in time is wrong. I believe that joining the Minutemen during the American Revolution was absolutely right. So it's not that I'm 100% opposed to the concept of military. I am opposed to joining this military right now. And every single time that the military spends millions of dollars bribing NFL teams to, you know, have salute veterans or salute the troops or whatever it is that they're putting on there, and we respond with something that's basically invisible, we are doing young men and women in America massive disservice. Say what you will about my messaging, but I'll tell you one thing. It was heard across the Libertarian Party. And if I'm president, if I'm elected president, or if I am just the nominee, you will see a massive cultural change across the United States. If there's somebody that can make an issue the center of discussion among a large group of people, I'm one of the people that has that particular talent. I do want to get to the last thing, because the last thing is often the most incendiary for people, which is the age of consent issue. There are a few reasons that I brought that issue up. One is that in 2008, that issue was used to attack Dr. Ruart, who should have been the nominee. Dr. Ruart would have transformed the Libertarian Party for the better instead of getting one Republican light after another. We had Bob Barr, who went on national TV and said he didn't want to legalize marijuana, who later nominated Mitt, endorsed Mitt Romney. That's what we got instead. The age of consent issue was used to attack Dr. Ruart, and I knew for a fact that it would be used to attack me, because at some point, that's what they do to anarchist candidates. They ask us, do you believe in the age of consent? And any anarchist is going to say, no, I believe that should be a family issue. And I wanted the Libertarian Party to have time to wrestle with that difficult issue, because I knew without any question that in 2020 at the convention, if I didn't bring it up, someone else would. So I brought it up on my terms. And the simple fact is this: you can either say the government should be involved in age of consent or that it should not. As an anarchist, I believe that is a family and individual matter. I don't believe that government even could do it correctly. And if you want to see how wrongly they can't have, no government could ever do it, consider when you have two people who are, say, 13 or 14 years old who are having sex with each other. The only two options you can get is saying that it's okay, or say that they're both criminals. Neither of those is a tenable solution. It is wrong, but it's not criminal. And that's why it's important for families to be there making those types of decisions, or individuals to make those decisions and pay the consequences for them. Teen pregnancy is one of the biggest problems we have in America today, because it grows the welfare state. And even if two teenagers aren't necessarily the victims of each other, all the taxpayers in America are. So I brought that up for a reason, because it is always used to attack hardcore radical anarchist candidates. It was used to attack Dr. Ruart. I knew for certain it would be used to attack me. And I believe that part of being a libertarian leader is making sure that we wrestle with the difficult questions that lie at the center of our philosophy.
I agree. And I think that some of the things that you're going to have to, in my opinion, that you're going to have to, I don't want to say work on, because I'm not an expert, right? That would be me taking way too much credit. But I do think that there will have to be a major distinction made between age of consent and the pedo community that is out there that likes to use that, and likes to, when we say it's just between families, likes to use that in regards to saying that that is okay. And that with the age of consent, we have some people in our party that will say that the age of consent is wherever the family wants it. And then we do have some that say that it is their responsibility as a parent to dictate when their child can have sex and who they can have sex with as their guardian. Much like we have with an actual member who is a lifetime member, which is a totally different discussion that we can move to at a different time. But I do think that you do get people to thinking, and you do express libertarian ideology in a way that brings things to the forefront that we would not normally speak about, or that would not be considered respectable politics. And sometimes we all have to work on our messaging, and sometimes, much like going to Daniel, when he seems to only have taxation as theft as the only thing that he can tout out there in everything that he does, taxation as theft sometimes rubs people the wrong way. And so Daniel's going to address that issue now on why the only thing that he seems to have to offer is taxation is theft, and why just being a catchphrase is enough or is not enough. Daniel?
Why is it enough? Well, make America great again. What did that do for Trump? There's, you know, why does Nike have just do it? These are actually really valuable in getting support from people and getting them to support an idea. So, but I also get the idea, you know, I'm told that it rubs people the wrong way. The reality is this: the people who it rubs the wrong way are all libertarians. I've worn this hat, and I have this sticker, which it's a Berman 2020 sticker, but underneath it, I don't know if you can see it at home. It says taxation is theft. Usually I wear this hat with a bigger black and yellow sticker that says taxation is theft, and you can see it from a mile away. I've been campaigning and wearing this hat where Democrats will come up to me and they'll say, "Do you really believe in that?" Now you would think like, okay, this is rubbing them the wrong way, but in reality, it's not. It's not rubbing them the wrong way. It's getting them to stop and ask a question. And now I have an opportunity to have a conversation with them. Now I know this is, you know, this is a hardcore Democrat who believes in, you know, the government should provide all kinds of public education. We should always be sending more money into public education, you know, healthcare, all these other social programs. And I know I'm not going to be able to win them over in a 5-minute conversation, turning them into some radical anarchist. Yeah, taxes suck. Taxation is theft. It's not going to work. But the reality is it does stop them. It does get them to talk. And now we can actually have a discussion like, well, do you like how your money's being spent? Well, no. And to the hardcore Democrats, well, what about all these wars? What about all these bombs that are being dropped? The Democrats are usually, no, I don't agree with that at all. Well, you're giving your tax money. Why don't you stop giving tax money for the bombs? Give them the money for the schools, but don't give them the money for the bombs. Well, we can't do that. We just have to give them an amount and they decide what to do with it. Well, don't you think that's wrong? And then they start to get the idea, okay, well, yeah, there is something screwed up with the tax system. And then I can take that conversation a little bit further and say, well, maybe if instead of being forced at gunpoint to give all your money to the government, you could say, well, I earn this much. I want to give 10% of what I earn to schools. So now you're voluntarily paying for education and you give 0% of what you earned to dropping bombs. Wouldn't you like that system better? And they start to think. Now, of course, they're going to come back with and say, oh, yeah, but then all these rich bastards, they're not going to spend any of their money. They're too greedy. They're not going to. Okay, fine. That's something else we have to deal with. But at least we're planting seeds and we're putting ideas in their head for them to see things in a way that they haven't seen them before. So the reality is the most people who come to me and say, yeah, don't use taxation as theft. That's offensive. Most of those people are libertarians who are afraid to say that to other people. And I want to say this also. When I first learned that taxation is theft, I was robbed twice. Once by the IRS and once by the California Franchise Tax Board. They just helped themselves to money out of my bank account because they decided that I owed them some amount of money, even though they'd already taken plenty. They took everything I had. I had nothing left. I still can't figure it out to this day how I earned a certain amount in 1 year. I didn't spend a whole lot on luxuries or anything like that. I paid my rent and bought some food and some other things, and somehow I had nothing left. So basically everything I worked for went to rent and food, and that was it, and it was gone. And this was a pretty good amount of money I made that year. I still can't figure that out. And so when I started seeing that, I was like, this is wrong. This is theft. How is that their money to take? Now I'm broke. Now I'm poor. How am I going to pay my next month's rent? And I had to wonder, why is this, you know, what can I do about this? Who can I call? Who can I talk to? What can I say? And I was afraid because everything I hear everywhere, it's, oh, you don't want to say anything bad about the IRS. Make sure you fill out your 1040 forms. Don't miss any numbers because then you're going to get audited. all these things, like, don't say anything. Taxation stuff, shh, don't say that. The IRS is good. They're listening to your phone lines. They're going to come after you. Everybody is afraid to speak out against the IRS. Worse than the CIA. I mean, I hear people talking shit about the CIA everywhere I go, but you want to say something about the IRS? No. People are afraid of the IRS, and the reality is they're not that big of a threat. They're not that big of a fear. That's all propaganda. Like, we hear, oh, yeah, Al Capone. That's how he got busted. He evaded the FBI and the local police and everybody else, but he couldn't evade the IRS because the IRS is the worst. The reality is that's not true, and we still have freedom of speech in this country. And so what I'm doing by saying taxation is theft everywhere is reinforcing everybody's right to freedom of speech. It's saying, hey, don't be afraid. Like, yes, the IRS is there. Yes, they might come after you if you screw up on the forms or if you try to hide your money or all these other things. But if you're paying your taxes and you just say the IRS is a criminal organization and they're stealing money from everybody, that's your right. And you should be able to say that. And you should be able to say that without being afraid. So these are some of the reasons that I use this message so much. And one final thing I want to say about that is everyone has at least one government program that they can look at and say, I hate that program. Maybe it's the military. I hate that program. They're dropping bombs on innocent people. Maybe it's the FDA. I hate that organization. They make healthcare really expensive. Maybe it's the Department of Education. I hate that. They should let our schools decide what the curriculum is going to be. Everyone has an agency of the government that they hate for some reason because it's making their life more difficult. And how is that organization funded, whatever organization that is? With taxes. It's all central to the entire system. You give them the right to take money from you without asking questions, without even having to say that what we're going to pay for is important, and you have written them a blank check to take all the money out of your account at any time without question, and they are going to go out and spend and create all these programs that crush your rights and take away your freedoms. And there's nothing you can do to stop them because you can't stop giving them money. So this,
well, I think within the catchphrase of taxation is theft, you have three individuals. You have the individual who already realizes that, and so they're right there with you, so you're preaching to the choir. You have the other individuals that don't want to hear it, may believe it, but they love their program so much or the government or the state so much that they're not going to listen to you to begin with. And you have the other people that it becomes an, and we're probably not going to get that second group. Hopefully we already have that first group. It's that last group of the icebreaker that hopefully we are moving into the Libertarian Party. But I want to know why Ben thinks that he should be running for president instead of a local race when that's what he thinks that we should be focusing on. I think we lost your sound, Ben.
Not yet.
Do we have Ben's sound?
Hey, what about now?
We have it now. So I want to know why you're running for president, other than the fact that you want to shine light on felons' rights. We get that, and I think that's important. But you talk about how important the local races are. Why aren't you focusing on that?
Well, you gave me the easiest question. That's easy. I'm a convicted felon, Kerry. I cannot run for those local offices. So that's why I spend so much time asking everyone else that can run for those local offices to run for those local offices. Because if I was not a convicted felon and I could run for those local offices, that's exactly what I would be running for right now. And I wouldn't be here tonight with Daniel and Arvin. As a felon, I can only run for federal offices, U.S. Congress, U.S. Senate, and of course, president and vice president. I chose to run for president to make this an issue, to hopefully inspire some other people that are convicted to run for, you know, Congress. We have 435 congressional seats that they can run for, another 100 Senate seats up up for grabs. And I think that's why I said earlier that running felons for those, especially consider we don't have a track. We've never even won one of those. So we don't even have anything to lose by running, a convicted felon in those races. We have everything to gain in the sense of the people who are not voting that might start voting if they see, hey, wait a minute, this guy's a convicted felon. He's the system the way I see it. It looks like he's going to do something about it. If anybody's going to do something about it, it's somebody that's in the same boat that people in that boat can relate to. So I wish I could run for one of those local offices. And in lieu of my ability to do so, I ask everyone watching this video or ends up watching this video, if you can run for local office, please do, because I cannot. I wish I could.
Well, and I hope y'all don't think that I'm being too hard on y'all. I want to ask some really tough questions that y'all know are going to be asked of y'all by other delegates or by the media or things that people might be discussing behind closed door. And I want you to be able to answer them for yourself, knowing that Ben was an ex-felon. I figured that would be his answer. And that may be the biggest thing that is held against him. For Dan, Dan's probably thing is going to be that he doesn't even live in the country and he doesn't isn't a leader within his own state, and he has just taxation and theft. And, of course, with Arvin, the things that me and Arvin talked about in that first question are going to be some of the things that people are going to hit y'all with or try to keep y'all from getting the nomination. I want to do a little lightning round thing to where I'm going to talk about, like, whether you're pro or con, and I'd like for you to just say whether you are for or against, as an example, ending the Fed. Y'all would probably all say y'all were against that, right? Y'all want to keep the Fed.
I think pretty much we're all in agreement on at least that one thing.
I've already got the whole plan to disassemble it ready.
So that's an easy one, right? Ending the Fed. Some of the things that are kind of contentious within our party is immigration, the wall, pro-life, pro-choice when it comes to abortion. So those I'm going to stay away from because we're either going to discuss those in depth or we're going to discuss those later. But how are you for individual rights for all? So I don't have to really say gay rights, women's rights, minority rights, felons' rights, just the term individual rights for all, which I use constantly. I'm assuming everybody's for that, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why did you do it like that, Arvin? Yes.
And it just seemed like there was like a trick question there. Yeah. I just wondering like who would possibly say no to it?
Rent is theft.
I'm against that.
Against.
I'm against, but I do want to say, I have talked to some of the people who push rent is theft, and I think there's the issue of the divergence of groups in that conversation actually comes from a different interpretation of what the word rent means. So it, in normal terms of, you know, people paying rent for an apartment, then absolutely, that is not theft. But in other economic terms, such as forcing rent, I guess rent seeking is one of the ways to describe it. Using government to forcefully create a system where people are forced to rent, then that is theft. It's a theft of opportunity. So I think that's, sorry, there's no yes or no to that anymore for me.
Does that become
honestly? Daniel does not understand the concept of lightning round. But we will continue. So what about private property?
I believe in absolute protection of private property in all circumstances whatsoever. That if you haven't given something voluntarily, it's yours.
Dan?
Absolutely. If you don't have the private property, then what do you have?
Dan?
Yep, absolutely.
Gun ownership.
Well, I've said boldly that I'm in favor of legalizing all weapons, including automatic weapons.
Okay, Ben?
Yes, I want to repeal the 68 Gun Control Act, as well as the Federal Firearms Act of 1934, which made automatic weapons illegal. There's a few other legislative items that have passed over the last century that we call gun control legislation. All of that should be repealed. Absolutely.
Dan?
The ATF should be a convenience store, not a government agency.
So I will tell y'all that in 2018, one of the things that I said on stage was, if you can afford it, buy it. And that's where I stand on that, just so y'all know. Child Protective Services.
I would get rid of the organization. It has done so much damage. I understand the intention, but the effect has been to demonize homeschooling parents, to go after parents who are using different methods that actually work but aren't government approved. I understand the intention of it, but the effect has been so atrocious that I would get rid of it immediately.
Dan?
So it is a problem to be addressed, and the reality is people want to elect leaders to solve problems. We need to figure out a solution that doesn't involve force and government agencies to do that, but we can solve those problems and we can help kids who are in trouble with child abuse and other issues without having government seeking war on drug, whatever they're going to use it as an excuse for, to take kids away and profit.
Ben?
I kind of agree with Arvin's position that I think that this is an agency that we can completely do away with, and I'll tell you why. What would be the big consequence of doing away with Child Protective Services? We already have law enforcement. If somebody was abusing their child, that's a crime. We can be arrested and charged and convicted of that. Why do we need this special agency that, you know, micromanages family affairs to uphold the laws that are on the books? I think we just do away with this one, save the taxpayers some money.
Now, y'all notice how Dan stopped it from being a lightning round, and now all of y'all want to just say yes or no. You want to give your
well, you're asking complicated questions.
This one needed a little bit more than
I understand. Sex work
is work.
Okay.
To me, sex work is work, and government work is theft.
Ben?
Yeah. There's an Australian model. Models are indicating that where this is legal, the intention of having these laws in the first place was supposedly to protect people, but it's done quite the opposite. And by bringing the industry out of the shadows, we protect everyone involved.
Department of Education.
Abolish all government schools, abolish the Department of Education completely.
Dan?
I would say a systematic dismantling. But from the federal level, get rid of it immediately.
Yeah, way to be a little statist there, Dan. Ben?
This organization is about as old as I am. We did fine. We scored higher before we had it than we do now in international comparison. This is another agency that we could do away with and let the states decide how they want to handle their education.
Now, I don't think I needed to make this note for everybody, not only for the three of y'all, but for our viewers, that the fact that the reason I'm asking these things for you to respond on a federal level, not on a state level, because in the state of Texas, we would have to have a constitutional amendment to stop the funding for our state public education, as opposed to it being something that happens at the federal level with the Board of Education. Now I want to talk about drugs. And we always get asked about drugs because we're libertarians, and there's some great movements happening in states in regards to the use of cannabis and industrial hemp. But we often don't see the same movement when we talk about psychedelics in the form of mushrooms, other drugs that many people would seem as completely harmful, much like meth and heroin, in those realms, crack, cocaine, things like that. Are y'all a all or nothing type of legislator, type of president, or is it baby steps? And what I mean by that, are y'all a, if you want to buy the drugs and use them, that's your prerogative because it's your body as long as you don't harm anybody else? Or are we as a nation of laws still going to dictate what you can and cannot put in your body? Dan?
Is this still lightning round?
No, we've moved on from that.
All right.
Not like we were ever there anyway because of you. Okay.
So this is a really interesting question, and there's a few different ways to look at it. First of all, you know, like I said before, the government and its laws and its policies are reflective of what the people want. So if we can't convince the people that heroin should be legal, and if we somehow just could walk in an executive order and make it legal, it's going to be illegal again as soon as, you know, the next day or as soon as we leave office, or maybe that'll be an excuse to impeach us. So what we really need to do is get an understanding to get people to accept some of these drugs. Now, if you look at it, first of all, most of the harder drugs that people are doing, I mean, people do crazy stuff. They huff paint. What are you going to do, ban paint? Like, they, when you start banning drugs and make it difficult for them to access the fun stuff like weed and shrooms and all this stuff, then you kind of force them to say, well, let's see, what is there around the house that I can get high with? And this is how people start mixing chemicals and coming up with cocktails of things that are killing people faster, but they're getting them high, and it's great because they can't buy anything legally anywhere else. So by legalizing, you actually solve one problem by preventing some of the hard and home-baked drugs, all the drugs that are mixed in with other things. And then you also have to address the problem that, you know, we need to get the mindset of people to be accepting of this. The reality is if we start legalizing, then we're going to start realizing, just like Colorado did. Colorado legalized marijuana, and then we realized, hey, this is actually a good thing. People are using it less. It's not, you know, there aren't deranged maniacs running around like we thought there would be. And so that's used as momentum to say, okay, well, let's start legalizing it everywhere else. And if you start doing test pools with legalizing cocaine and some of these other drugs, then you know, you can start doing that. Now, there is a little bit of power with executive orders where you could reschedule some of these drugs so that they're more legal. But of course, that still has to be reflected by the will of the people. What we can do is we can pardon a lot of drug offenders, nonviolent drug offenders, for their offenses, because the reality is, you know, a lot of people who have drug offenses on their criminal history, well, they went through a phase in college where they tried a few different drugs and now they're scarred for life with this criminal record and they can't get a job. You want them to say, oh, well, go get a job and be a productive member of society. But first, why should anybody have to be a productive member of society if they just, you know, want to find some leisurely way to live their life as a bum? Hey, let them. But you're at the same time, you're trying to tell them, hey, go get a job, but you can't get a job because you gave them a criminal record and you're unwilling to take that off of their record. So it's a really complicated issue. But you know, of course there's a solution to it, and anybody should be able to put in their body whatever they want, as long as they're not harming anybody else.
Thank you for the simpleness at the end. Arvin?
He already went.
Now, when it comes to libertarian culture, yeah, I'm a bit of a heretic because I don't think drugs are good. I wouldn't smoke a joint on camera. I wouldn't smoke a joint in private. I don't do drugs at all. I don't like them. I don't think they're a good way to promote human flourishing. That said, I also believe that by and large, drugs punish themselves. So for example, if you start doing a lot of heroin, you will pay the punishment. Having the government do a punishment on top of an inherent punishment in the thing, is to me just unnecessary. It's like junk food. I don't think it's a great thing to eat, but if you eat too much of it, it's going to punish you all by itself. That's why I don't believe the government has any business getting involved with that. And here's the fact. You know, Dan said that if we get in there and start pardoning people, we're going to have an uprising. That's simply not true. Because everyone in this country, if I'm the nominee, I promise you this, everyone in America will know two things. One, that if I'm elected, I'm pardoning everybody. And I absolutely believe that it's your right to do whatever you want with your body. Whether I think it's stupid or not, you have the right to do whatever you want with your body. And two, everyone in America will not only know that I can do that, but that they can do that. That they can use the power of jury nullification, the thing that brought freedom of the press to America, to judge the content of the law, not just the facts of the case. And I promise you this, if I am the nominee, I'm not even saying if I'm elected, if I'm the nominee, we're going to either massively scale back or even end the drug war, because we will have an actually informed jury in the United States that's going to do to the drug war what the jury in the Zenger trial did to restrictions on freedom of the press.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, much like the gun control that issue that we spoke about earlier, this is something that's happened over almost the last 100 years. They started putting, what was it, the Controlled Substance Act. And, this all started happening in the 30s. On a federal level, all of this legislation needs to be completely repealed. The agencies that have sprung up as a result of this legislation, i.e. the DEA, and certain, you know, divisions within the FBI and other agencies. If the state want to have some kind of authoritarian drug policy, if they want to have an authoritarian drug policy and pick a random state, if that's what the people of that state want, that's their business. But the entire country should not be forced into an arrangement like this. And that's my thought on it. Federally, we need to repeal all of this and let the states decide how they want to go and go their own way.
Okay. There's a lot of different groups in our country that the two old parties have a tendency to claim ownership to. The Republicans will have a tendency to claim the middle class, the older white Christians, gun owners. The Democrats will often say that they are the party for the workers. They're the party for minorities, blacks, Hispanics. GSMs, which for me is gender sexual minorities instead of LGBTQ. Those individuals within those groups have a tendency to vote at a higher percentage for those two old parties. And being a member of one of those communities, I have a hard time making headway in that community to lure those, and lure is probably a bad word, but to educate is maybe better, to educate or awaken those individuals that old party really doesn't care about them and that the Libertarian Party does. How would you make headways within those communities for us to get a better than 3%, a better than a 5%, not only in a presidential race, but for that to trickle down or to help with our local races that are important for us to win? Ben.
Well, I think you just kind of said it there at the end there. considering that the libertarian view is really based on the individual, it makes me scratch my head sometimes how we look towards this presidential candidate to achieve these new heights as if that's it isn't, there's not a trickle-down politics, and we need to give up on the idea of trickle-down politics, that we're going to get some guy in here that's magically all these votes are going to trickle down because people liked our presidential candidate. How this is going to work is by people running for local office, state council, county commissioner, sheriff, things like that, and building that grassroots following there locally and developing that real relationship. I can't be in Lubbock on any type of regular basis, but you're there on a regular basis. That's your community. You can build the position and the brand there. And by adding up all these local campaigns who have had the time to really make an impact there locally and develop relationships there locally, break the stigmas and the stereotypes there locally, that's gonna, I don't know what the word I'm looking for here, trickle up, but that's gonna blast up towards our larger, races, whether they're statewide or national races like the president. The results that the presidential race gets are determined upon how strong we are on the grassroots level. And that requires building real, meaningful, tangible relationships in the community, not looking towards some type of national figurehead to magically make it all better.
But you do realize, and you would have to agree, that based on the conventions that we have seen and based on the conventions that we have had, that there is a sea of white. There is a sea of men. And we are not reaching out to minorities or other groups. And often when individuals from those groups do come in, they are questioned and they are ostracized and they are pushed back from and not made to be welcome. How do you think you could make those individuals feel welcome as the nominee?
Well, it's kind of like, here we see a lot of factions within the party, and those factions have that same effect on people who are not a part of those factions. And my message generally is don't let anybody try to define for you what being libertarian is. That's something for you to figure out for yourself. And I simply encourage people to stand strong in their convictions and not be backed into corners or be bullied or to be shooed away or driven away by, somebody within the party that may not appreciate their presence there for whatever reason. There's always going to be somebody in any group of party or any, large group like this that is not going to appreciate your presence. There are people that don't appreciate my presence in the party. There's people that don't appreciate Arvin's. There's people that don't appreciate Berman's, although I don't know who they are. And there's people that don't appreciate yours, Carrie. And we've all experienced
this. Bite your tongue.
Yeah, well, we've all experienced this. Remember when you ran for lieutenant governor, there were some people trying to convince you not to. Well, who are they? And we all saw how the nomination went. You ended up getting the nomination because nobody had the courage to run against you because they knew.
Standing ovation. Make sure you had standing ovation.
Standing ovations.
That's why I'm not running for president, because I want you all to have a chance.
Yeah. And when they saw that you had the grassroots support, there was nothing that anyone could do. And, the Libertarian Party of Texas, we put forth an openly gay candidate on the ballot for lieutenant governor. And, it must have been pretty difficult for guys like Dan Patrick to realize I'm not the most pro-gun guy on the ballot. You were. You were better on so many issues than both alternatives. And
okay, it's not about me. This is about y'all running for president.
Sorry, we got distracted here. But by putting forth candidates like yourself, by putting forth candidates that might represent some of these demographics and allowing them to embark upon this libertarian journey and not trying to micromanage everybody, I think that that's going to foster the environment that we're looking for. The micromanaging and the accusations of who's libertarian enough and so forth, that's counterproductive, and I don't do that.
Well, everyone is libertarian enough, and everyone is libertarian. Dan, how are you going to reach out with your candidacy to those individuals and those groups that are not often part of our party but are seen to be owned by the two old parties?
So I've already reached out to a lot of people who aren't libertarian. And in fact, that's where I've been spending a lot of my focus so far. The reality is that a lot of people who are already, you know, very determined to stick with their party, they're actually really interested to hear what I have to say. And this, you know, like I said, this isn't something where you can convert somebody in 5 minutes of meeting them. But if you actually talk to somebody and you understand their needs, and instead of just giving them the rhetoric of, you know, yeah, we're gonna legalize guns and legalize drugs and all this other stuff, you find out, you let them talk and find out really what their issues are and what their problems are and figure out a way to solve them, then they actually really get interested and they start considering voting for someone that's a third party. But I think Ben is right. There's not this, you know, there's not a trickle down thing that we can expect. We're not going to convince a bunch of people to vote libertarian, because the reality is, you know, for one, as libertarians, a lot of us go around saying, yeah, people should stop voting the party line, because what does that mean? You're voting for people just because of their party and you have no idea who they are. Well, what happens when we have some of these people that come into the Libertarian Party who aren't libertarian? Are we doing all this effort to promote the Libertarian Party just so that a candidate who's not really libertarian by whatever the popular consensus is to determine if someone's libertarian or not, to help that person get elected too? And then that person goes out there and says, yeah, I'm a libertarian and I think we should go full on communism. Then doesn't that kind of reflect back on us? So I think realistically, like, we don't want to convince people, hey, vote for this party. What we want to do is we want to talk to people. We want to let them know, hey, we actually do care about you and the issues that you're facing. And we actually have libertarian solutions that involve you getting more rights and more freedom and more money in your pocket and solving all these problems and difficulties that you're having in your life. And this is really the best way to get across to people. And they appreciate that you're not just giving them, you know, you're not just regurgitating rhetoric. You're actually listening to their problems and solving them. And they go and tell their friends and they spread the word. And what's really interesting about this, what I find really valuable, is when I spend a lot of time talking to different libertarians, it's the echo chamber. We're all saying and hearing the same thing. We don't learn and we don't grow from it. But when I go out into the community and I talk to people who have no idea what a libertarian is, and I think I know the solution to their problem, and I say, well, hey, what about this? And then we go back and forth and we actually have a discussion, then I find out, oh, there's actually more of their problem beneath the surface. And I actually learn a lot from them. And I figure out more ways that libertarianism can actually be applied to solve more problems that we didn't even know existed. And this is really, really, really important to connect with these people, because if we can't connect with the people, they're not going to vote for us. It doesn't matter. They turn on the TV, it's Democrats and Republicans, and those are their options.
And while I will tell you, while on the campaign trail, because of being involved in one community and being at a lot of prides, most of the people I met knew nothing about what libertarian were all about. And that was a big conversation that happened. And I believe we gained some votes, or at least we gained people actually putting their eyes and their ears on us. Arvin, how do you hope to accomplish that, to be a greater focus or a greater messaging being heard by those individuals that the two old parties believe that they own?
You know, as one of the minorities in libertarian leadership, you know, I was vice chair for 2 terms, representative at large. I served in the executive positions inside the Maryland Libertarian Party. I mean, I can tell you that if somebody had found some way to like pander to me because I'm South Asian or whatever, it wouldn't have worked. I mean, what spoke to me were the fundamental truths that made sense to me. Listen, I'm not like clever or smart enough to be able to know the right thing to say to each individual person, but I am clever and smart enough to know what the truth is. And I believe that the presidential candidate needs to be able to clearly and concisely articulate that truth, not to explain to people why that truth is good for them, just to explain what the truth is, why it might be good for some people, and let people come to their own conclusions. The libertarian message is, for example, that government schools are wrong. That sometimes gets traction among homeschoolers and private schoolers, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it gets traction among gay men and women. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it gets traction among you know, racial and ethnic minorities. Sometimes it doesn't. I mean, it's not that you can say that this one thing is going to land with this one group of people, because when it comes down to it, we're pulling people out of all these different groups and showing them this idea. The one thing that I have noticed, though, in the last year and a half or so of much bolder, much more aggressive messaging, is that in almost every room I've been in, whether a physical room or, you know, virtual community like Facebook, there have been at least one or two people who hadn't said a single thing about the topic at all, who believed that everyone in the world believed the opposite of what they believed, and they just didn't want to be the one guy fighting against everyone. And the fact that there was someone there who was willing to go as many rounds as it took against the sacred cows of the state, who was willing to call out those who advocate military recruitment or government schooling, or those who advocate for whatever other statism, the fact that there was somebody there willing to stand by them helped them find their voice. So many people contacted me about these different issues. Probably the most intense moment for me was when a mom contacted me on Facebook saying that she'd wanted her daughter to join the military, and that the things I'd been saying had made her reevaluate that she was a libertarian. She didn't believe in militarism, and her daughter didn't even want to join, and that she, you know, backed off and had this whole major epiphany. And that wasn't because I was trying to pander to her. I hadn't met her before. It was because I was speaking the truth. Even some of the more incendiary things, you know, people say, like, when you're talking about, you know, people who are teenagers should be allowed to have sex, are you going to just reach out to pedophiles? Not really. A lot of the people who contacted me were of ethnic minorities, who talked about how their grandparents or great-grandparents had been married when they were 12 or 13 or 14, and how that marriage had lasted for 60 or even 70 years. The simple fact is this: libertarianism allows for real cultural diversity. And real libertarianism is what allows for that. When it comes to gender and sexual minorities, the idea that it's now okay to have two gay men be married but not three gay men, to me, that's ridiculous. To me, it's you need to have somebody who will stand up for the absolute libertarian principles and let the people to whom that speaks come forth. The greatest messengers in the libertarian movement, the greatest converters, have not been those who figure out clever ways to pander. They've been people like Ayn Rand, whose bold and unapologetic messaging reached out to so many millions of people, myself included. So if you're asking me, do I know some special way to pander to minorities of one kind or other, I don't. But I do know this, that in any group, the libertarian truth is going to speak to some people, and it's going to change their lives.
Well, let's be clear that I did not say the word pandering. That came from you. I was speaking about messaging only, and how that, and I think that you answered that in saying that speaking the truth, that messaging would be heard. Pandering was a totally different issue and not what I was referring to or asking y'all to do at all. I just wanted to make sure, because I don't want people to think that the answers that were given by the other candidates would be considered pandering. Because I think everybody just spoke to what they thought would be a way to get that messaging across, or at least that's how they. I hope you did.
Does anybody want to accuse anybody of pandering?
I don't know. Dan's messaging right now, the taxation is theft, it's so subtle and individually targeted that it kind of.
So now we've had a lot of people in the party who have left the party. And some of them have left because of our stance on abortion, which I usually do not call it abortion plank. I call it a reproductive rights plank, just to be clear. We have had some people that have left based on our immigration plank and our immigration ideology. And we have heard in the past that the Libertarian Party was founded on Judeo-Christian values and morality. I don't think liberty is necessarily Judeo-Christian. I think liberty is innately humane and human, and that is where it lies, not necessarily. People who have never heard about Christ or Jesus, or Jesus the Christ, however you want to put it, still want to be free, even if that's not what they call it. So how are y'all going to approach in the form of unity or sticking just with the platform those individuals within our party that are on those totally different fringes of completely pro-life, or in some cases people would say pro-birth, because however that works, or the people that are pro-choice up into including the day before a birth, as well as the open borders. I just moved them to different sides, didn't it? And they would never be on the opposite sides. Open borders over here as opposed to a wall over here. Does it matter? And are you just going to speak the truth when it comes to liberty? Or is there some common ground to be found in there? And Arvin, I believe it's your turn to go first.
I'll start with abortion first. When it comes down to something like that, realistically, nobody likes an individual child more than that child's mother. So I think leaving the decision-making in the child's mother's hands is probably the safest bet. Personally, I am anti-abortion. I am opposed to abortion. I think it is morally wrong. And honestly, my view on abortion is very similar to my view on sexual consent among teenagers. I don't think that teenagers should be having sex with anybody. I don't think they should have sex with each other. I don't think they should have sex with adults. I just don't think they should be happening, period. My view on abortion is the same. I don't think abortion should be happening. But I'm also aware that if you let the government do it, what it would take to stop it would be so much worse, so inhumane, so disgusting, so vile, with so many negative and predictable consequences, that I absolutely do not want the government involved in that at all. I believe that leaving that choice to the mother, who presumably, by the laws of nature and common sense, is going to care more for that child than anyone else possibly can, that is the person who I want making that decision. So while I'm individually very opposed to abortion, and while I know many people certainly disagree, I do believe that life begins at conception. I do not believe the state has any business getting involved in abortion at all in any way whatsoever. I oppose all restrictions done by the state on abortion. I do believe there are moral restrictions that individuals should hold to. When it comes to immigration, my view is very specific. I believe in open borders, no welfare. I will also take just open borders. I'll also take just no welfare. My ideal situation is open borders, no welfare, because I believe that immigration is not just what, you know, people think of it as, which is, you know, all these kind of people with, like, you know, difficulties and health problems and poverty coming in. Yeah, maybe it includes some of those, but it also includes people that have amazing talents, great ideas, innovators coming to America. I want America to be the place that has zero taxes, zero restrictions, no welfare, that attracts the hardest working, the best and the brightest from all over the world to come to the United States of America. And when people see that immigration doesn't just mean we're letting in, you know, somebody who's violent, but it means whether we're trying to get in, you know, people like Dyson. Why is he still in England? Why haven't we brought him here? Why are all these great tech innovators still in other countries? It's because we haven't made the right environment here. As president, I will make that happen by getting rid of taxes, getting rid of regulations, and making this the most inviting place for hardworking, innovative, productive, skilled immigrants.
Dan, your answer, sir?
So I agree with a lot of what Arvin's saying, especially when it comes to immigration. I think what's really difficult about these questions on any level is what are the expectations of the answer? Because as typical politicians, they usually have some sort of rhetoric that's, you know, okay, this is the answer. And they know statistically it's going to get X percent of the crowd excited about the answer. When it comes to libertarianism, we're not looking for rhetoric. We're actually looking for solutions to problems. Like, the world has problems and people want leaders to solve those problems. So one of the problems is that we have too much government, but other people have other concerns. So there's two questions here. One is, what is the end game? What is the ultimate utopian paradise that we'd be able to like to see? And that would be like what Arvin talks about, open immigration, with no welfare, so that people can travel freely throughout the world, that people aren't worried about other people being dependent on them and abusing those systems and all sorts of other things. The reality is the government is a very complex beast that we can't just go in and cut the cords and hope everything's going to fall into place. For example, if we were to open the borders right now, then obviously we have welfare problems, we have the drug war problems, all these other issues that really need to be resolved before we can just say, okay, now there's no immigration problem and we can get rid of, you know, Border Patrol and everything else. We can start, maybe we can just get rid of ICE right now because that's not an entire, that's not the entire agency that's, you know, quote unquote, protecting the border. But, you know, so there are different components. And so, I talked about systematically dismantling things before. These are things that we have to worry about, you know, like we saw what happened in Katrina when a levee burst, right? That caused a lot of damage. But imagine if you had slowly drained the water or put it somewhere else before dismantling that levee, then all these homes and lives and everything else wouldn't have been destroyed. And we have to look at that. Government is basically a big dam that's creating all kinds of problems. It's creating economic pressure in between two countries. It's creating economic pressure between two classes of people, maybe even in the same city. It creates all these problems, and we need to relieve that pressure before we remove the system, or else a lot of damage is going to happen. The other part of the question was about abortion, and I think this one is, you know, this is another really difficult one to answer, because you've got a lot of people who are for it and a lot of people who are against it. They both have really good points to support their arguments. Ultimately, Arvin's right. Government really shouldn't be involved in that. But, you know, are we going to expect that everybody one day is going to agree on one side or the other? I don't think that's realistic. But if we look at it and say, okay, look, why are there abortions? Is it because people don't have money to raise babies and they say, oh, let's abort it? Is it because it was unplanned, unexpected? The parents parted ways and now no, they don't know who's going to raise it. You know, are these all the problems? And can we find solutions to these problems so that we don't have the people getting into the situations that require them to even consider abortions in the first place? These are all interesting problems. And, you know, these are the conversations we should be having instead of saying, you know what, this is just the way it is. There's always going to be people who want abortions. We need to either decide to completely ban them or completely legalize them. It doesn't have to be so black and white. And that is that, I think, contributes to the polarization and division of the country that really we should be fighting against.
Ben.
You know, I don't think that there is one answer for abortion. That all of society is going to be happy with. But one thing that I think here is once again, why is this a federal overreach issue? Why is the federal government dictating the lifestyles of the entire country? If people of the state want to have their abortion laws or lack of thereof a certain way, let that state go that way. That was the whole point of something like states' rights. And I think that is a step in the right direction, that the federal government doesn't have business in this issue, and state level governments are perfectly capable of sorting this out to best suit the residents of their state. Instead of people in one state trying to tell their neighbor state how to live, that just doesn't sound like freedom to me. I think that states' rights is a solution. As far as immigration is concerned, this is another complex issue. Open borders works in a place like Europe, let's say, because you can go from, you know, France, you know, to the UK. You can travel around. It's two-way travel. However, we could say tomorrow, we the people of the United States now no longer recognize the border, and we you know, the next day we get a message from Canada and Mexico, both saying, well, we appreciate your new attitude on the border, but we just wanted to remind you that the line is still where it was the day before, and our border policies are still in effect. Therefore, I would like to see better treaties, better migration treaties established, especially with our neighbors to the north and to the south. It's no easy task necessarily legally migrating to Canada or legally migrating to Mexico. I mean, I can never be considered a full citizen of Mexico. They don't have a provision for that. I wish that they did. I don't think that this is a solution, you know, or necessarily something that's going to be solved by saying, okay, United States is now open borders. What did that magically change? I want to see a relationship. I think that our neighboring countries need to participate in this journey towards this direction of greater freedom of travel. I think that society on a global level is ready for greater levels of travel and then ability to move from one country to another. But it's a matter of negotiating, you know, trade and migration deals with our neighbors to where not only can people come here, but we can go there. And that's important to me, that not only can people come here, but we can go there. That it's a two-way street. We have fair deals.
Thank you. Many individuals believe that our government has not done right by our indigenous population. And it is often an overlooked, not only voting demographic, but also where we have gone wrong with our treaties and with our dealings with the sovereign nations of indigenous individuals in this country. How would you remedy some of those situations that arise, especially when it comes to things like the pipeline that goes over some of the actual sovereign nations? And this can also include some of your eminent domain comments, should you choose. Dan, can you start us off, please?
Sure. So I think it's a really great and broad topic. But I think, you know, one of the biggest lessons we can learn from that is government can't be trusted. I mean, it gets huge, it gets massive. It says, oh yeah, we'll take care of you. We'll promise not to bother you on this land here. We'll make all kinds of treaties. And then it says, you know, oh, well, that's not convenient for us anymore. And you don't have the military power to stop us. So we're going to cancel this treaty and we're going to do what we decide to do. Also, I think there's sort of a different issue in as far as property rights. This is, you know, something that everybody expects, that government registers property, and that's that. And whoever has the property registered by the government has the final word. Well, when you have indigenous people on indigenous land that's supposed to be their own sovereign land outside of the United States, but within the United States geography, most people don't comprehend exactly what that means. Does that mean that there's a deed on file somewhere with the United States government or within, you know, whatever state that it's in, with the government saying that these certain people hold title to this land? No, we have to understand that property ownership is more complicated than just having a list somewhere of who owns what. And we need to respect those rights. If somebody's on a piece of land, you know, we have the historical laws and everything that go along with adverse possession, squatters' rights, everything else. There's really a lot of interesting scenarios that most people don't consider. They just think, okay, well, if somebody buys this land, then they own it, right? But what happens when somebody's on a piece of land for 50 years or 100 years and they treat it as their own land, and the government says, well, nobody owns this land, so I guess we can sell it to somebody. We'll assume it's ours, we'll sell it to somebody. And then the buyer says, oh, well, it's our land now, but there's people on that land. Does that give you the right to kick these people off? They've been there for 50 years? Or do you have to say, well, they didn't go to the government to register that property, but to some degree, they own that property. That's theirs. So I think this is, you know, we have to kind of educate people as far as what government's role is in property. It's, you know, just because they have a register that says somebody owns something, that's not the final word of God as to whose, you know, whose property that belongs to. There's a lot more to consider with that. And I think, you know, so that goes to the property rights of that. I think it's a really difficult situation because I think there's also a lot of racism that goes into it where people just say, oh, well, they're Native Americans. Who cares about them? I mean, there was a lot of propaganda that went, you know, when the colonies started expanding, when Americans started traveling west and, you know, they're savages. There was a lot of propaganda that went into that, and that created a lot of racism, the same as we're seeing today with, you know, Mexicans and Muslims. So I think, you know, what we really need to do is start educating people and putting, you know, get people into the light. I've had Muslims on my podcast recently, so we can actually have a conversation, because I meet so many people who never met a Muslim before that the only picture they have in their head is the racist images that they see on movies or in propaganda. And it's the same with Native Americans. You see, you know, Adam Sandler got a lot of shit for it. The last movie he put out, or a couple movies ago, where he was basically reinforcing all these stereotypes of Native Americans. And there aren't a whole lot of movies where you see Native Americans just as Native Americans, as actual people, seeing the struggle from their side, seeing the crap that they have to put up with from the government. As far as eminent domain, I'm not entirely sure that should have ever been put in the Constitution in the first place, but I understand it was put there for emergencies. If the country's being invaded and, hey, we need to set up a fort right here, or we're going to be completely overtaken by an army that's going to kill everybody. That's kind of what it was there for. And now we see that they're doing it for everything. Oh, we need to build a parking lot, eminent domain. And they're taking property away from people. This needs to stop also. So there's really a lot that goes into this. And I think, you know, enlightening people to what's really going on is a big part of it.
Dan?
You know, I don't know what the answer is necessarily for these reservations. We're looking at an issue that was set up a long time ago that probably shouldn't have even been set up the way it is to begin with. So I don't think that anybody was ever necessarily happy or thrilled with the relationship or the nature of the deal. I don't think that the Native Americans who are on the reservations, I don't think that was their idea of a good deal to begin with. So it started out a bad deal. And then we're still involved in this bad deal. And we have a Bureau of Indian Affairs that's essentially not run by Native Americans. And it's just a bad deal all around. I don't want to say what the answer is here with, you know, without first hearing from various different groups of people from these reservations on what they think the answer is and how to move forward from here. Because like I said, this started out a bad deal. So I don't know if there's a way to make a bad, all of a sudden just magically wave a wand and turn what's always been a bad deal into a good deal or a fair deal or an equitable deal. I think that it's a situation where people are gonna have to come together and really take a look at the issue and stop turning the other, you know, way and ignoring these issues, because these reservations are dealing with some pretty big poverty issues, addiction issues, and it's
murder,
kidnapping
at a higher level than anywhere else in any other place.
And it really seems like it's not high on anyone in government's priority list to help out with this situation. Also, the unique arrangement with the reservation, local law enforcement can't be much help. You need special law enforcement that have, you know, access to there. And it makes me wonder, you know, is that exacerbating the situation? I think it needs to really be looked at, that the whole nature of how we got to where we are with the Native Americans in America needs to be analyzed, revisited, and that rather than to force a solution upon them, I think that they should be given a voice and a platform as far as what can happen here to improve that situation for them and to bring them into the country more so. I don't like the idea of the two Americas here, the Native America and then, you know, I guess the rest of us. I'd like to see us come together and then for them to feel just as much a part of this country as anyone else.
That would be pretty much the reason why I said indigenous peoples. Arvin, knowing that you've dealt more on the national level, being an officer and being on executive committee, this may have been something that y'all have touched on in the past. So do you have anything that you would like to add?
Yes. The issue of sovereignty rights, the issue of the rights of Native peoples, it's an issue that's actually very important to me. When the government wants to destroy a people, whether it's an indigenous group, whether it's a minority group, they first will try all kinds of force, which they certainly have done with most minority groups, and they certainly did with the indigenous peoples of America. And when that phase of destruction is ended, they go to the second phase where they use welfare dependency to put that final nail in the coffin. And welfareism has wreaked limitless havoc on Alaskan Natives, on Native Americans in the continental United States. It has done so much damage. At the same time, the problem almost presents its own natural solution. When you look nationally at what happened, internationally, at what happens when small groups are given true sovereignty, or even something close to true sovereignty, you see flourishing. You see that in Hong Kong, which had a little bit of sovereignty compared to the rest of China and became one of the major cultural, financial, and technological centers of the world. And what I would like to see happen worldwide is countries, instead of stealing land from people, to actually start to sell sovereign land to individuals. In the past, countries used to sell sovereign land to each other. You know, we had the Louisiana Purchase and the Gadsden Purchase, et cetera, et cetera. I would like to see that happen again. The way to start that internationally is through foreign aid, is by ending foreign aid and allowing foreign governments to run out of money and have no choice but to sell sovereign land. But we can start that here by upgrading the partial sovereignty given to the indigenous people to full sovereignty. Ben says he doesn't want there to be two Americas. I have to respectfully disagree. I want there to be 50, 60, 1,000 Americas competing with each other. I want them to have full sovereignty. I want there to be a place where if you want to pay super high taxes, there's going to be a place for you. And if you want to pay no taxes, but there's no government school, there's a place for you. I want to see the original idea of 50 competing states, 50 laboratories of innovation taken to a whole new level. And we're given a golden opportunity to both correct a historical wrong and also bring that great libertarian idea to the forefront. And my approach to that would be to upgrade the partial sovereignty to full and complete sovereignty. When it comes to things like pipelines, it would be no easier to build a pipeline across a Native American country than to build a pipeline across, you know, France or Spain without their permission.
I bet y'all weren't expecting that question, were you?
No.
I didn't think so. So when we're talking about, and I just want to, being from Texas, sometimes we have a massive Texas nationalist movement here in Texas. We also have a massive militia movement here in Texas. Do any of y'all oppose Texas removing itself from the Union and becoming the Republic of Texas again? Dan?
So I think this is a really interesting issue. I know
this is the last question, by the way.
All right.
We'll have, because we're going on 2 hours, and I want us to be fresh each time, by the way.
Sure. So so Ben and Arvin have both touched on some very interesting issues about localizing sovereignty. Ben talks about states' rights and being able to have their own rights. The reality is, the way the Constitution is written, if you read it, it's an agreement among sovereign states. We talk about, you know, should there be open borders? Oh my God, what's going to happen if we have open borders? We have open borders. There's 50 states, 50 nations that you can travel freely in between as part of the United States with no restrictions. There are, you might have been paying taxes into one system. Now you have kids and you take them to another state. Well, those kids are now sucking off the welfare from by sending their kids to that public school. We have all these same problems between states. And so when we talk about, you know, what are the states supposed to be? Well, the federal government really isn't supposed to have this much power. And if you look at how much power they have, it's not really in the original agreement. That's really a breach of contract, isn't it? So why shouldn't a state be able to secede from the union and say, hey, you know what? We don't want to be a part of you guys anymore. I think my camera just went out. We don't want to be a part of what you're doing anymore because you're not keeping your end of the bargain. We should be able to leave. And there's, I'm sure there's plenty of legal precedent that you know, says you have to have an exit clause to every contract. There has to be a way out of it, because otherwise you're basically signing yourself up into involuntary servitude forever to a contract. You should be able to get out of that at some point, whether that's seceding from a union or canceling a contract, especially if the contract itself has already been breached. So I think absolutely Texas needs to be able to do that. And, you know, when we talk about restoring states' rights, that's exactly what it is. And why not take it a step further? Why, you know, like when we ask, why does one person in Los Angeles have the right to change the laws that are going to affect a person in New York? Well, why does somebody in El Paso have the right to affect the laws that are going to affect somebody in Dallas? Just because they're still several hundred miles away, but they're in the same geographic box. It really doesn't make any sense. So once we get back to states' rights, then we should go further and get back to cities' rights. And maybe that's going to look something like what Arvin's been talking about with his 50 different Americas and smaller sovereign nations that are more like city states, which is kind of like what Hong Kong is. I think there's a lot of latitude to do with that. And we need to stop looking 3,000 miles away for answers to our problems and start looking locally and trying to fix them locally. And then we'll be able to have more freedom in that way.
Arvin, your thoughts on the Republic of Texas?
I think it's a great idea. I'm a strong believer in complete sovereignty. I would take it further. I believe that every person should be able to buy sovereign territory. And I think that if the United States stops sort of subsidizing the way things are done right now, it's going to happen. It's going to happen in the United States. It's going to happen in foreign countries. What happens today is through organizations like the IMF, et cetera, the United States prevents private groups from really being able to buy sovereign territory. If it wasn't for the IMF, the World Bank, U.S. foreign aid, countries would run out of money and we would have competing countries, thousands of small competing countries, each with different laws, different regulations, different taxes. I would love to see that happen here. I think Texas could be 20 or 30 small countries. At the very least, I would be 100% in favor of Texas being able to leave. In fact, if Texas does choose to leave, before they do, I'm probably going to hop on board and be one of the leavers.
You mean you're going to move to Texas?
I'm going to move to Texas. If Texas is leaving, I'm moving to Texas.
Well, do realize if Texas does move into its own sovereignty, y'all can all just endorse me as the first president of the Republic of Texas. Dan, what are your thoughts on a Republic of Texas?
I feel that as a native Texan, that every one of us native Texans, or I speak for a large majority of us when I say that there's a small part of every one of us that wants to secede just because we feel like we're our own country anyway. We are very much almost treated like we're from a different country. It's just Texas has a really strong identity, which is important that if you're going to break off and you're going to form your own country, that you have such a strong identity, or as strong as identity as Texas does. Not every state has that. Not every state has that certain level of identity that would make them necessarily want to do that. But I think that every state should have a pathway, Daniel Berman was saying, some type of exit clause for the contract. I think every state should have the right to secede. I think that the entire country also should have the right to secede in the same way that our founding fathers did. There's a group called like the Fourth Continental Congress, for instance, who's experimenting on trying to do a redo. There's the Texas Nationalist Movement. There's secession groups all over the country of various different forms and flavors. And I think that that's great. I think that what that does is that keeps alternative ideas on the table. That way we're not married to one forever. And we have the ability to say, you know what, I think it's time to go with plan B. And every state should have that right and should have considerations. And I would even go so far to say, and this is non-federal, non-presidential issue, but I feel like the state of Texas, and I think other states should too, should have provisions within their state constitutions that say, if the federal government does X, Y, or Z, we are going to break off. The deal's broke. Automatic triggers for secession. And if we had some automatic triggers for secession built into our Constitution, that would serve as a constant reminder to those in Washington that if we do X, Y, or Z, Texas is out automatically. And that's a huge thing to have to consider when you're in Washington making decisions. Is the result of my decision going to be that I'm going to lose an entire state, one with a GDP the size of Texas? That's a lot of money. I feel that that's a way that we could, as all 50 states, could put pressure on the federal government, is to institute provisions within our state constitutions to say, if the federal government does X, Y, or Z, we're automatically going to enter secession. We're going to dissolve the relationship.
Awesome. We will now have closing remarks. Once again, we'll go backwards this time, so we'll start with Dan.
Your mic. Microphone.
Taxation is theft.
Ben?
Man, it was incredibly fun to do this with you guys, as always. I look forward to doing it again soon.
Arvin?
I guess I'll keep it simple, too. My goal is to end the income tax. It's to end the welfare state. If you want to learn more, please visit votevora.com. Debating with you guys, discussing with you guys has always been an incredible experience.
So let me just say, I had a lot of fun with you guys. I hope we have more candidates join us in the future. In the future, I would like to talk about your thoughts on the Electoral College versus the popular vote. I would like to talk about your VP choices or what you're using to choose who you would have as your VP, as well as the way that the Libertarian Party chooses its VP. I would also like in the next one for us to talk about what you think are your best things that you bring to not only being the nominee, but to the party itself. So those will be some things that we'll talk about in the future. I don't know why, since it was switching to everybody else, now it's just staying on Arvin instead of switching to me since I'm talking. I hope I wasn't too hard on y'all. I hope y'all didn't feel like y'all were singled out too much. Know that if I do this in the future, I intend to be hard-hitting. I intend to ask some tough questions. I tend to sometimes maybe even come across as a complete ass. And I think that's because some of our biggest issues that we have within the party is unity, messaging, and the biggest thing is the fact that we infight and we try to one-up each other of who is the biggest, brightest libertarian in the lamp, and we often bring our own thing that moves the party and moves liberty forward, and we seem to forget that, and we seem to forget to praise each other and the good that we do, and we often simply just stand around tearing each other wrong and throwing darts into the balloons of ideas that each one of us have. And it's an awful shame, because as we do that, we are destined to fail and to not win, which is our goal. I thank you. Everybody who watched this, if you have questions that you would like the future candidates to answer, please send them to, where are we going to have them send them, guys? Y'all want them to, I don't want them to send them to me. Crap.
You could send them to either one of us.
Just send them to somebody and they will pass them on to me.
We'll pass it around.
I'm on Facebook. If you want to send them to me on Facebook, I will hold on to them. I'm really excited about our crop of candidates. I think we have a great diversity of people that we can pull from, and I don't think anybody's going to be too upset with any one person being the nominee.
Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
I'm as bad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.